Hello, everyone. In today's episode, we interview a good friend of ours named Jim Morgan. Jim is the CEO and founder of SemiGen Incorporated. They are a RF products and services company in New England. We did this interview in our hotel lobby in Boston at the IMS show in June of 2019. We think you're really going to enjoy it. We discussed a lot of things ranging from entrepreneurship to the trials and tribulations of being a small business to the future peril of the manufacturing industry for RF products in general in the United States. So we think you're going to learn a lot, and please enjoy. So Jim, you and I have been friends for what, 4 or 5 years now?
At least, yes.
At least, okay. Yep. I remember, so when I met you, you were the you were starting out SemiGen, or you'd been going around for a few years, but it turned out that you had a very deep and lengthy career that I didn't even know about. And you explained to me very quickly that you could do everything that I needed. You could do all the diode packaging, you could even make the diodes. And I said, who is this man? So tell me, who is this man, Jim Morgan?
Thank you, Chris. I mean, I'm no different than anybody else. So I'm 53. I grew up in the 80s, and I'm a Reagan, and I know we don't talk politics on this particular show, but let's start out with that, because the roots of me, of who I am as a person, it really started in 1980 when Ronald Reagan took office. And you know, the country had gone through some tumultuous political times similar to what we're in right now. And Reagan came into office, and Reagan, for me anyway, as a 12 or 13 year old ninth grader, brought a vision of the American dream. And that you could be anything that you wanted to be in this country. You could start a business, you could be this, you could be that, you could do anything. And you know, I had a brother who was, I'm the baby of six, so you know, all my brothers had done better than I did.
Six
kids in my family.
But you're the youngest?
I'm the youngest of six. So there's 23 years between myself and my sister. Right? So when I came on and I grew up in the Reagan era, and I watched, you know, the hostages get released out of Iran, I watched President Reagan turn the economy around, I watched a big emphasis on business and how important business was, and more importantly, how important manufacturing was to America and to the Defense Department and to the soldiers that we have fighting for the freedoms that we have. So, you know, I looked at that and I grew up with that, so it was kind of in my blood. So when I got to a senior in high school, I was deeply in love with this girl who I met, and
it
now
always
my
starts
parents
with
were
that.
Trying.
Backstory.
It really does, right? Right?
Because
that's
kind of
like the
yeah.
right. That's kind of like the, oh, a girl screwed up my career.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like I was destined to go to or I was set up to go to Bridgewater State College in Massachusetts and play football for those guys because I was a high school quarterback. So I wanted to go play football for them, and I was like, all right, I'm going to go do this.
You just glossed over the fact that you were a high school quarterback.
42-1.
In the 80s. 42-1? Did you go to the
one,
state championship?
Two state Super Bowls.
Wow. Do you have the rings?
No, we don't do Super Bowl rings. We get a little trophy that says we participated.
Wow. So, okay.
No different than it is today.
Hunky Jim Morgan, high school dreamboat, graduates.
Yeah, not even close.
In the era of Reagan. Go on.
In the era of Reagan. So I had this girlfriend, and I was like, you know, I really don't want to go to Bridgewater State College. I don't want to leave, so I'd rather go to work and start my own business. So what I did was I started a bakery, of all things.
Was this something that like modern times, it's like everybody starts a business, it's very entrepreneurial. Were a lot of people going out and randomly starting businesses after high school?
You know
school
what, in the 80s it was a big deal. Like you could do anything you wanted to do. And okay. That was kind of what it was in the 80s.
Yeah,
the 80s was a very free-floating, free-like style type time. It was just crazy. I mean, you could do anything you wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start this bakery. So anyway, I graduate in June of 1984. I start the bakery in September. And what I did was I rented an ice cream parlor that closed its doors from September 1st to May 1st. And I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to run this bakery from, now this was my idea, run it from September 1st to May 1st and have the whole summer off. So it was going to be just
brilliant.
Like school.
Yeah.
I get to work.
You were like a teacher.
That's right.
But
like a teacher, but bigger. But like, and I was going to light the world on fire with like muffins and croissants. So I didn't bake anything. That was the thing. I didn't bake anything.
You had no talent.
Wait. I teamed up.
Did you have any knowledge of baking or cupcakes?
None at all. But what I had a knowledge of was.
Did you even know how to leaven bread?
No. I didn't know anything. So it was like.
No leavening.
No leavening. No leavening, no yeast, no nothing. So what I did was, I said, I have a bakery case. I have an ice cream shop. I'm going to sell ice cream. I'm going to sell pastries. I'm going to sell coffee. I'm going to sell cigarettes. I'm going to sell magazines. I'm going to get people to come here and hang out. Oh. And I'm going to make all this money, right? So I teamed up with a bakery, an actual baker, in a bakery in Beverly, Massachusetts. And I used to drive at 5:30 in the morning to his store, pick up all the stuff I needed for that day, bring it back to my shop, and sell it.
All the stuff to bake or all the baked goods?
No, all the baked goods. Done. Okay. Done.
Finished.
Why do I want to manufacture?
Certainly.
Why don't I outsource that? Okay?
Good Reagan capitalist.
What a great idea, right? So, I ran this thing. We sold something like 450 pies at Thanksgiving. We sold another 500 pies at Christmas time, right?
Did you rebrand it like Jim's Pies?
You know what? It was just called. It was called the Bakery Shop. I couldn't get any
marketing
more than that.
You've come a long way
no
since
thought,
then. In
there
terms
was no
of,
thought put into this, right? There was no thought put into this. So, I worked this thing for September, October, November, and December, and I came down to the week between Christmas and New Year's, and I was devastated because I had sold over, I don't know, $2,000 worth of pies, right? And the book said that I was approaching a $6,000 loss for the year, okay? So my dad, who was an amazing individual, fabulous engineer in the microwave industry, started at CBS Hytron in the 1950s, was an engineer with the Coast Guard during World War II, actually saw combat in the Aleutian Islands. Not a lot of people know this, but the Japanese actually landed people on the Aleutian Islands.
U.S. territory.
U.S. territory back in 1943. And my father had hand-to-hand combat with in the war. Yeah. And he was wounded, and he had a service medal and everything. So anyway, my dad comes into my room, and I'll never forget this, and he goes, "You're $6,000 in the hole. This is business?"
The greatest generation.
Right? And I go, I'm like, wait, well, I said, we're just starting out. I mean, he goes, you have 4 months before the ice cream lady comes back. You're never going to make $6,000 in 4 months. You barely make $500 a week, and you're coming into January, which is dead of the winter. He goes, you're done. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, I'm done. So now what am I going to do? And he goes, well, he goes, you're going to come work at the time at Microwave Associates, which is today MACOM. So you're going to come work at MACOM. You're going to be a technician on the point contact and Schottky diode line, and you're going to pay back every single one of these people that you owe money to, because I owed money to everybody.
Yeah, right? $6,000.
So in January, right after the holiday, January 3rd, 4th, whatever it was, 1985, I started at Microwave Associates in Burlington, Massachusetts, in Building 1 as a technician on the point contact and Schottky diode line.
Okay? Making how much?
Making $5.17 an hour.
Okay, so that's ten grand a year.
If that.
Like yeah. 10 to 12 grand a year, something in there.
Yeah.
And you had $6,000 of
$6,000 to pay back.
So, nope. So you were buried in debt.
I felt like a millennial with student loans.
Yeah.
It was perfect, right? Same analogy. When you.
Hey, what are they complaining about?
Right, I mean, what are they complaining about? Yeah. I did this, so it's like $200,000 in debt. Piece of cake. Get a job, pay it off.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, I went to work and I started to work at MACOM and I started to learn about diodes. And I started to learn about how to build diodes and how to manufacture and how to test and what X-band was and what S-band. I mean, we were building S-band diodes in waveguide that you could put a VW bus in. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was a great learning experience. And then, so the entrepreneurial bug, in around February of 1986, my father was going to retire in October, and in February of '86, I said to my dad, we should go into business against these guys. This is easy stuff. Now, I'm 20 years old. I just turned 20. And my father...
How long have you been working there? 2 years?
A year. One year. Okay?
Enough time to learn the business.
You're 20 years old, you're like, I'm ready.
I'm ready.
So a millennial before his time.
Exactly. Except not as entitled. So But the thing that was interesting from it was that my father had tried to buy semiconductor companies throughout his career as well. So there was a team of people back in 1972 that were assembled to purchase Alpha, what was Alpha Industries, from GTE Sylvania. And this is kind of an interesting story. So this, my dad, this guy Jim Breitenwischer, and a bunch of these other guys had put together some money, and the money people were out in New York, and they were actually going to buy what ended up being Alpha Industries. They were going to buy it from Sylvania, because Sylvania wanted to divest the division in Woburn. So the guy that was the money guy was on his way back from New York, meeting with the VCs that were going to front the money to buy the company, and he was hit crossing the terminal at Logan Airport and killed.
Almost like you today.
Okay, almost like me today, that's right. I almost got hit by a postal truck.
Thank God for your president.
I know, right? So the VCs, because he died, the VCs were not interested anymore because they didn't know the team up here. Yeah. They knew the money guy. So the money guy died. And then two guys, the Karyotis brothers, which was George Karyotis and his brother, ended up buying what it was Alpha Industries, and not a lot of people know this particular story, but they bought it for $10,000 down in a 7-year note. And when they went in and they took over the company, they laid off all the assembly people because they had over 3 million diodes in inventory. And the engineers, my dad was one of them, the engineers spent 3 years characterizing, grading, and sorting diodes that were in inventory to sell to the government, because these were all in the B-52 program, was their biggest program back then.
Yeah.
Okay? So you had 1972, you had the height of the Vietnam War, you had all this stuff going on, they were shipping hundreds of thousands of parts out of the place. Well, the Karyotises ended up paying GTE off in about 6 years of the 10-year deal. And that's what became Alpha Industries, which then became Skyworks Solutions. Okay? So then, fast forward to 1980, my father was involved with another guy that he was involved with in that original 1972 clan, and they were trying to buy a company up in Newburyport, Massachusetts called Chemtron Industries. Chemtron was owned by a guy named Tom Castellini. Tom Castellini had passed away. His wife owned the business. So my father was trying to buy the business. So he hooked up with a guy at MACOM who was a friend of his, who I won't mention his name for the sake of not mentioning his name. He'll probably hear this podcast and he'll know who he is. Anyway, he went in and he said, hey, look.
The way the RF industry works, everybody will know who you're talking about.
Right.
But because we're politically correct, we don't actually name names.
That's right.
Here.
We don't name names, it's just going to be negative. So what happened was, my dad went in and confided in this, because my dad was a great engineer, but he was smart enough to recognize that he wasn't a business guy. So he wanted a business guy to run the business. He would run the engineering. He needed a business guy to run the business. So he went in to this guy at MACOM and he said, look, I have an opportunity to buy this from Tom Castellini's wife. Tom passed away. They're building 1N23s, 1N21s, 1N products. And he said, I'd like to buy this thing. And that particular individual took that opportunity to go to senior management at MACOM at that time and tell them what my father's plan was. And MACOM ended up going up there, offering them twice the money that my dad was going to offer them, and they leveled the place into a parking lot and sold off the land. What? And all of that inventory and all that equipment ended up in a warehouse somewhere in Chelmsford, which, when I joined MACOM in 1986, I was tasked with breaking up some of this Chemtron equipment and bringing it back to Burlington at the time to implement it into production. So in February of 1986, I said to my father, let's go into competition against this $900 million company and let's do point contact dials, because it's always been your dream, and I'll do the business side of things and you can do the engineering side of things. And
Wait, hold on. $900 million, MACOM was doing $900 million in
1986. Yes, they were.
What are they doing today?
Not $900 million.
Not $900 million. But the company's been changed like 100
times.
Well,
I know. Like, it's weird.
It's like MACOM's like a band where there's like one original guy. And then they just like change out the drummer and the bassist every couple of years.
It's kind of like Van Halen.
Yeah.
But they're not, they're more like a tribute band.
That's Wolfgang.
Yeah. At this point, it's like, who, what do you have, link do you have to these guys?
Okay, so some version of MACOM in mid-1980s. Deserved a competitor.
Right.
And you're stepping up at 20 years old, and you're like, hey, Dad, I could do this.
Right.
But the dad's already tried to buy like five companies.
Correct.
Did he ever succeed?
No, never succeeded.
So he wanted to buy a company as far back as you can remember, basically.
Far back as I can know.
Okay. And so he was making offers.
What happened? Like, where's the?
So my father looked at me and he said, "Look, we don't have any money." Again, six kids. When he retired from MACOM in 1986, he made $42,000. Okay. So I said to my father, I said, "I'll raise the money." So we were having a lunch with a guy by the name of Ernest Jolly. And Ernest Jolly, his nickname was Buzz. Ernest owned a company called Rhode Island Electronic Ceramics. And what Rhode Island Electronic Ceramics did was they supplied all of the ceramic diode packages to MACOM. So we used to go out to lunch with him all the time. And my dad would introduce me to him and we'd go out to lunch. So one day at lunch, we're on our way out to lunch and my father goes, "Do me a favor, I've known Buzz for 5 years. Don't pitch this deal to him, okay? He just sold his company, he doesn't need to hear this, he doesn't da-da-da-da-da. Just don't pitch this idea. Just don't pitch it."
I think we all know you listened.
It's safe to say. So I went out to lunch with these guys, and in the middle of the lunch, Buzz says, "Well, you know, I just got $4 million from selling my company, and, you know, I'm kind of looking for my next thing to do." So I said, "Well, it's funny that you say that, because my dad and I," and my father's like kicking me under the table. Like, I probably still have the bruise somewhere here,
yeah, right.
Right? So my dad's kicking me under the table, and I'm making this pitch to Buzz, and Buzz picks his glass up, and he goes, "I'm in for 30. And goes like that. And he wrote me a check the next day for $30,000. And then we went out, and we brought another partner in, and we brought another partner in. We raised $50,000, and we had five original partners in the company. Each of the people owned 20%. So I own 20%, my dad owned 20%, and the other guys owned 60%, okay? And we started the company. And then the long story short is Micrometrics started. And Micrometrics, one of our original partners was Bob Fallon. Mm-hmm. And Bob Fallon had owned Parametric Industries. And Bob was a very unique engineer, mm-hmm. entrepreneur, business person, very successful company in the 70s and in the early 80s. And he was a good friend of mine. He was a good mentor. He was genuinely passionate about this industry and passionate about how to do certain things. And it was good for a 20-year-old to have that, because you can have your dad, and your dad's kind of like your dad. But when you have somebody else that's kind of pushing you and kind of giving you that
guidance.
That's
like you to me.
It kind of helps, right?
So like, I got my dad, and then I got you.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I'll call you at 2 o'clock in the morning like he used to. So I'll be up
because the baby's crying.
Cool.
Anyway, it's fine.
So the company started, and you know, we did $47,000 our first year. And I think this is important for our techie people out there to know that when I started this company, I had a customer list that was printed out on green and white dot matrix paper, 11 by 17 with the holes on the side, which nobody even knows what it looks like today, right? And this customer list was like 5 inches thick,
yeah.
Okay? And it had company, it had address, it had phone number, and it had a contact name. And you literally had to sit there and dial the telephone, okay? Dial the telephone with a rotary telephone, every single one of these numbers, and make contact with these. And then you had to take a catalog, and you had to put in an envelope, and you had to write out a label, and you had to mail it to them, and you had to wait a week or 2 weeks for them to get the catalog, and then look through the catalog, and then call them back. And it was a constant management of customers, trying to develop customers the old-fashioned way. Reaching out, making a phone call, getting on a plane, traveling, seeing
hustle.
Them.
Just pure hustle.
Pure hustle.
Yeah.
Pure hustle.
Yeah.
So when you think about that $47,000, that was like 500 phone calls. Because in our business at that time, the average order was like $800. So you had to make a ton of phone calls to get that money. So as time progressed, and this is back when fax machines used to give you, they didn't have cutters in them, so the thermal paper would come out in one big long strip, and you had to sit there with a paper cutter and cut the paper up, and if you were too far down on the roll, they rolled up like the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then you had to try to level them out, put weights on them, and I mean, it was a lot of work. And when you think about that, it sounds kind of like immaterial, but the point is, that took time, right? So you couldn't get all that stuff done, and then make those phone calls and do all those different things. So it was an interesting time to start a business. And we so we started it in 1986, and then in 1987 we did our first MTT show, which was in New York at the Javits Center. Mm-hmm. And then we moved on from that, and then we hired reps, and then we grew the company, and then
So what were the original products?
Point contact dials and Schottkys.
Okay. And did you know anything about that?
Not a thing.
Who did?
My dad.
Okay, so he was the tech guy.
Right. So day one, Micrometrics opens right after Labor Day weekend. In 1986, and I'm sitting in my office, and I went out and I bought this desk at an antique store that was an old banker's desk, and it was like 72 inches wide by like 4 feet long, you know, 4 feet wide by 72 inches long. And I got this big banker's desk, and I'm sitting there. I got my spreadsheets out. I'm got all that. My dad comes into my office, and he goes, "All right, come on upstairs," because we were in a mill building, where if you put your pencil down on your desk, it rolled off by itself. Mm-hmm. And then the third floor, wooden floors, we had the production area, right? And so we had
in the diode producing area. You can't even put paper in like a clean room.
Trust me, this thing was not a clean room. This thing was so rudimentary, it wasn't fun.
That was the U.S. military, like,
correct.
Nuclear program.
B-52. Right, yeah, we're building plane parts.
High rel.
So he goes.
We're really lucky the Russians didn't fire.
Oh, God.
You want to see their factories.
Jim Morgan's Micrometrics diodes, like, destroying the United States' chance of victory.
So he comes down, and he says to me, come on upstairs. And I go, what? I got work to do. He goes, you have no work to do. He goes, until you know how to build it, how to test it, what goes wrong with it, he says, you can't sell it. So he goes, come on upstairs and learn how to build these things and learn this product. So I spent the first 2 years of my company managing the company, my one employee, building diodes, wire bonding, die attach, tests, every facet, okay? And these are the days when dads of engineers, you'd have to etch these silicon chips in hydrofluoric acid, okay? How many safety protocols do we have today handling sulfuric, nitric, or hydrofluoric acid, right? Because hydrofluoric gets in your skin and it just bubbles it up, right? So you'd walk into the back room with my dad, and he'd etch chips, and he'd be etching chips with his bare hands, right, with hydrofluoric acid in a beaker, and he's going, "Don't do this," right? And he's etching these chips, and I'm just like, "But you'd never get away with that today." But that's the way these guys did this.
Yeah.
So we just built this company over this long period of time, and Micrometrics grew 7 to 10% a year over a long, long period of time, and The way that we pulled it off was really by wheeling and dealing through acquisitions. We made our first acquisition in 1992, gave us fab capability. We made our next acquisition in 1995, gave us a Knox Semiconductor, 2005, gave us Knox Semiconductor, gave us some epitaxial capabilities, gave us some other stuff. So in my career, I've done about 13 acquisitions and one divestiture.
Mm-hmm.
But The way that I've built these businesses is I've built them by buying companies that are not doing as well as they could do, walking in, taking a look at it, seeing a vision, and being able to implement and execute on that vision.
That's kind of like the Warren Buffett model.
Smaller scale.
But that's usually the thing. It's like you look at a value proposition where you're like, if I just ran that, they would do better.
Right.
And that's always been his thing, right? So here's something interesting, though. You spent a lot of time the first few years just learning all the nitty-gritty details of what went under you, okay? How important is that to you? Because like one thing that I criticize a lot of the M&A activity in the industry is that I feel like these companies are coming in and buying people and they don't understand the business. You've done 13 deals. How important is it that you as the leader, but also as the, you know, how important is it that your executive team understands what they're buying almost better than they do? You have to have that vision for them, right?
Well, not only do you have to have the vision for them, but one of the problems is that, you know, and I don't mean any disrespect to anyone in the industry who has come into a general manager's job or, you know, or as a vice president or is I mean no disrespect to any of those folks. I know that they went to college. I know that they worked hard.
Here we go.
I know that they did all that.
This is good. Okay, I'm ready. Ready.
But go. In all honesty, the fact of the matter is that I have to really relish in what my father's teachings were. And my father's teachings were, if you don't understand how to build the product, you can't manage those people who build the product.
That's right.
If you can't understand what the people who build the product go through on a daily basis, you can't understand how to manage those people effectively. So when you don't understand what your $20 an hour or your $15 an hour assembler is going through every single day, to sit there for 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week and do the same thing over and over and over again, if you don't have an understanding of how that is, you can't effectively create a culture that is a highly motivated, highly efficient, and highly passionately caring company personnel, which is vital to profitability, right?
Yep.
So the what I see in all these mergers and acquisitions is I see a total disconnect where management in larger corporations, and I worked for one for 2.5 years, and I honestly, I'm not a big corporate guy. Yeah. I'm not gonna work for a bonus to screw my assembly people. I'm not gonna work for a bonus to screw the shareholders. I'm not that type of person.
And you're not gonna take the short-term gain personal for sacrificing a long-term strategy. I think that's a big problem that internally at Marky, I have this like kind of weird and complicated statement that I always tell all the employees is, I don't care about profit and I don't care about growth. Which is not actually true.
Right.
But the point is, I'm trying to emphasize, do not take the short term. Take the long term.
But see, when you don't care about that, it happens organically.
Exactly. And that's what I would say. I say, well, obviously I care because that would mean we're doing the wrong thing.
Right.
But I don't care on a day-to-day basis. I look at the numbers once every quarter, once a year. Like, I really don't focus that hard on it because I think it is absolutely true that when you're actually focusing on execution, the employees, they follow.
Right.
Because they don't want to deal with that either. I mean, so you and I, like, you know, we own the companies or whatever, so we don't have this stress that we could be laid off. So if the numbers don't look good, we're not, like, at risk like other people are. I don't want my employees to worry about that.
Right.
Because if we keep doing, I want them to trust that if they do what I ask or if I empower them to move in that direction, they'll be fine. And who cares about the numbers? Because there are a lot of things you can't control.
And look how successful that's been for you. Look how successful that philosophy has been for me.
That's right.
Now, you know, is that a scalable philosophy? I don't know. Is it scalable for what a large corporation wants? For what a $500 million company wants? No, because they focus on the wrong things, and they have the wrong people giving them the input to the company. They have their bean counters because they have to be Sarbanes-Oxley compliant, and they have to be this, and they have to be that. And the reality is that none of that stuff matters in the big scheme of things. Companies go backwards because management loses focus with the people that are their customers. They lose focus with their employees. They lose focus with the direction because they're concentrating on what they're going to put in their pocket versus what they could put back into the company in order to advance the business and have a future tomorrow.
Well, that's a fascinating point. So I've had many conversations today with people who are complimentary of what we've been up to at Marky. And I'm appreciative, but then I say, competitor X. They have more designers, they have more assets, they have more resources than I do. Why can't they beat me? And they say, they don't talk to the customer. They don't actually listen. And it's like, I'm glad they don't, but it makes no sense to me. Like, so tell me about this. So you brought Micrometrics up to a point. Tell me about, I don't actually know what happened to your dad. Like,
when? That's kind of a bummer story. So my, okay.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
So we don't have to go here.
It's fine. In 1992, we bought American Valence and Eagle Microwave because Micrometrics had been manufacturing point contact diodes, but we didn't have a foundry, we didn't have a fab. So we were actually buying and reselling our components from Frequency Sources at the time. Because my dad knew the manager at Frequency Sources, and they had a very good friendship. So we were like, you know what, we're all competing for the same thing. There were like 6 competitors in the industry. This is gonna give you a chance to get more market share by selling through us. We'll market up 10 or 15 points. We'll be able to turn. So we were acting like a quasi-manufacturer, quasi-distributor, but we were a private label distributor. Yeah. Does that make sense? So a guy...
Wait, but what was he doing with the hydrofluoric acid then?
Oh, he was etching point contact chips. This is what we were manufacturing. So that was part of our manufacturing process. So we didn't have a fab though. So the thing was, it was like, so we put in, we started to build this business up where we were getting PIN diodes and limiter diodes and step recovery diodes from frequency sources. We were going to customers. We were sampling them. We were selling them. We were making it work really, really well. And we're starting to build that business up. The general manager, who's a friend of my dad's, somebody else came in. Again, we won't mention that name. Somebody else came in and took over his job. And he called me down and he looked at me and he goes, I view you as a competitor. I'm not going to sell to you anymore. And I said, well, unless you want a lawsuit, you're going to have to honor all the orders that are on the books and then I'll figure it out. So at the same time that that happens, my son is born. This is 1991. My son is born. That guy takes over. And I get a call from my rep in Northern California, and he says, hey, this company, American Valence, is for sale. Are we good? Okay. American Valence is for sale. You should talk to this. The husband died. The wife wants to sell the business. There's an engineer out there that you should be able to keep, and she really just wants to get this thing moved. So very long story short, at 26 years old, 1992, 26 years old, I went out and I negotiated the purchase of basically a $900,000 business for $7,500 down. Does it sound familiar? $7,500 down and a 7-year note. And she took the deal. So we bought American Valence and Eagle Microwave. Fred Gelligan had worked for New England Microwave. He went out to California to start Eagle Microwave. That was a capacitor and pin business. American Valence was a varactor business, so the two of them were kind of merged together. We ended up buying controlling interest in both, and that's how Micrometrics got launched in 1992. And so Fred Gelligan joined my company as my vice president and an owner in Micrometrics, and we started to have a bi-coastal operation, and we started to grow that business and see what we could do with it. And basically what happened was the guy who called me down, if he had just said, oh, we'll just keep things the way they were, Micrometrics probably would have not gone anywhere. So it's kind of funny in business when you think that there are a lot of things that happen in business that push you in a certain direction that you never planned to go in, that someone else pushed you in that direction.
Yeah.
And had you not gone in that direction, mm-hmm. you never would have been successful.
Well, it's almost like a door closing opened up 7 more.
Right.
Yeah, we were just talking about that today with yep. some of the M&A stuff. It's like you and I have both benefited from this
right.
in many ways.
Well, I've actually benefited from, MACOM has contributed to the success of all of my companies, indirectly or directly.
I didn't say MACOM.
No, they have. And they have in a
good
way.
Whatever MACOM means.
Not in a bad way, in a good way.
Okay.
They've contributed indirectly and directly to a lot of the success that I have had because they've either wanted to sell product lines off or provide me the education early when I was there, and I have a good working relationship with those guys. It's just funny how it all circles back. Our industry is so small
yes.
and so incestuous sometimes
yes.
that you have to try to keep as many bridges intact as yeah. you can. You really don't want to try to burn bridges. You really want to try to keep those bridges intact because you never know in our industry where you're going to circle back right. to somebody else. So that, yeah. No disrespect to those guys at all.
Okay, so you formed Micrometrics officially when?
October 1986.
Okay, but your son was born in 90.
My son was born in 91.
91.
Yep.
And that's when you make this deal on the West
right.
Coast.
Right, so I make the deal to buy American Valence on the West Coast in 1991. I spend 5 months of my life out there. We put the whole deal together. We get this whole thing done. And now we're a bi-coastal operation and we're selling all over the place. And then we start growing the business. So the business goes from 800,000 to 1 million to 2 million to 3 million, or whatever the case may be. And what we ended up doing was I was very fortunate to be able to align myself with very successful people in the industry and just allow that to happen. So in 1995, we brought in a sales person who worked for Frequency Sources. We brought in Donna Langan, who became the vice president of sales and marketing. She ended up being a partner in the company, and she was the catalyst. She was like, I was this arrogant, pig-headed, stubborn, like know-it-all, And Donna came in and she was kind of like, all right, you're not doing anything like that anymore. Slap, slap. You're going to do it like this. And this is the way the business is going to be done. And we're going to get reps and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And it was just like, if anybody became my sister, my best friend, my mentor, it was her. So if it wasn't for her, if it wasn't for that marriage, that company never would have succeeded. In my opinion, it never would have succeeded because I was partners with Fred, and Fred and I were like different people, different personalities. Donna was the balance of that. So the three of us together, we were like the Three Stooges, but a successful Three Stooges, if that makes any sense, right? And it became a partnership over a 20-year period of time that played off of each other, played off of our weaknesses and our strengths. But together, we were a really good team. And we kind of pulled it all through. And then when one of us went off on a tangent, Donna was there to say, get back, you know, enough of this. We're going this way. And we made it together. And, you know, we built a $11 million, $12 million business between 1995 and 2007 when we sold it to Aeroflex.
You said you did 13 acquisitions in your career.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those were with Micrometrics?
We bought American Valence, we bought Eagle Microwave, we bought Epitaxial Products, we bought MACOM's point contact line, we bought Alpha Industries glass diode line, we bought MACOM's Epi product line, we bought Knox Semiconductor, we bought, and I think that's it for that. So there's seven there. In when I started SemiGen in 2009, I did an acquisition in 2010. I bought Alternative Microwave Resources, which was another assembly company, in order to give us more bandwidth. I bought Element Manufacturing in 2011, which gave us PCB capability. I bought, what did I buy after that? We went to Element, we grew that. We then bought, we bought Ion Beam Milling last year. And we just, acquisitions are great. But we're buying all sub $1 million companies and packaging them all together.
You think 13 out of 13, 13 wins, 13 good acquisitions.
Yeah, I wouldn't do an acquisition if it wasn't a good acquisition. So I have a talent for looking at something and being able to see something else. And it doesn't always end up where I want it to end up, but it's all for everything that I've done in the microwave industry. They've always ended up being a positive impact to the company.
I'm really curious about this because the idea of buying a company and having it not fall apart is so alien to me. How do you buy, when you say you bought a company or you bought a product line, say you bought a diode product line from MACOM, for example.
Yep.
You write them a check. What do they give you? Okay. Drawings?
No, equipment, backlog. Assets.
Employees?
No, we didn't take any employees because we did it. So that's value add. That's a value add business. We already make them.
Okay.
So we don't need that. We don't need the employee base in that acquisition. Okay.
Yeah.
But now take an acquisition like SemiGen did with Alternative Microwave Resource. They had 12 employees. We took all 12. We kept all 12.
Okay.
Okay. So every acquisition is unique in itself. And it depends on what you want to do.
Well, what are you looking for? So you've done 13. What are you looking for? What's the criteria for your decision making?
So the criteria is it has to fit in the product roadmap. It has to be synergistic to the business that we're doing. It has to be complementary to the customer base that we have. And it has to have value-added top-line revenue and profit. And it has to have a pathway for growth.
And a certain size.
And a certain size.
Yeah.
Which is manageable.
Yeah.
Because you can't, as a small company, you can't go out and bite a huge apple. You know, you gotta take small bites. So when you have an opportunity to buy $1 million company or $2 million company, that's a perfect acquisition size.
Yeah, for your skill set.
For my skill set.
Well, what do you
well,
think?
Well, it's not even skill set. Well, it's for what you have. You know?
What has made you able to, I guess, digest that bite? Like, not everybody does it. Like, we see a lot of failures, right?
Well, I think in our industry, people aren't doing what I'm doing. You know, people aren't taking businesses, they're buying businesses and consolidating it within my footprint, you know, my rooftop. They're not doing that. They're buying companies that are either bolt-ons, and the first thing that they do is they go in and they put their entire accounting system in there, and it changes the dynamic of the entire company immediately.
Yeah.
So the problem becomes is they say, well, we're going to come in and we're going to run the company exactly the way that it's been run. We're not going to change anything. I mean, you guys are doing great. Your salespeople are going to stay in place. Everything's going to stay in place. But they change the accounting system of the company. Accountants don't run production. Accountants don't run manufacturing. And a lot of these big companies, they do. And the problem is you can't come in and buy a company that's not a public company, not a, you know, it's a private company, mom and pop, or owned by a person for a long period of time, and bring an accountant in. Accountants are not entrepreneurs. I'm sorry. Accountants serve a valuable role, okay? That is, do my tax return, manage my books, and put my money in the places that they belong in. They don't belong in operations. They don't belong in systems. They don't belong in those things. They belong in a box. And the problem is that a lot of these corporations, and when Aeroflex bought us, that's one company that was very centric to our accountants have a role in operations. They don't have a role in operations.
Now, okay, so I think I generally agree with your perspective here. What exactly is the mayhem that's caused? Like, why is it that they screw it up? Like, what happened? If we sold, I can imagine why my managers and employees would be really upset, because I don't hold them to budgets. I don't have a monthly or quarterly expectation of output and things like that. Is that the reason that, like, in other words, the company culture has changed and they rebel? That's what I guess would happen. Is that what happens?
Well, I think that people who have worked for a particular private owner for a long period of time get comfortable. And I think that people are adverse to change of any kind. And when people are adverse to change, they'll sit there and they'll say, oh, this is good, this is great. But in the back of their mind, they're worried.
Yeah.
And they're uncomfortable. And it's not, and they don't even know why they're uncomfortable. They're just uncomfortable now. Now there's somebody else coming into the factory looking at what I'm doing. Now there's somebody else overseeing production. Now there's somebody else making comments about how we do things when we've done this for so long. I mean, how many times have you as a company owner sat there and gone out and said, look, we got to make this better. And the person said, I've done this way for 20 years. I don't know how else to do it.
Well, it's even different. Like, I would say it's as simple as I tell them, do this as if I weren't here. Because once you have those new eyes and, like, the new boss comes in, everybody clams up. I actually, we have this one really wonderful assembler. Like, she's great. But when I interviewed her, she was shaking.
Yeah.
Because she knew I was a Marky. And to her, I was like, you know, I controlled her destiny. And so I actually, I'm going to walk out of the room. And I went and got somebody else. And I said, can you do the interview? And she did great. And she's, you know, a huge asset.
So here's a perfect example of why things are different. Okay.
Yeah.
In my factory, the CEO, there'll be times when I have to go on the production floor because there's one thing that happens to be done that I know how to do it, and I know how to do it very efficiently, and we need to get this product out to a customer. How many people from any of the companies that have done acquisitions recently have the business manager or the vice president of the company sitting on the floor next to an assembler actually doing the work? Zero. And the problem is, Chris, that when these companies buy these other companies, they disconnect that connection of the owner sitting down doing work on the production floor.
Do you think it's possible for a large acquisition to happen where that disconnect is not so severe? Is there any way to mitigate it? Or is it just like anytime you see a $250 million acquisition, say, that's over, that's game over, sell the stock.
But you got to scale it. Right? Because a $250 million acquisition has a separation of that, of what I just talked about.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, if you go out, if you have a $600 million company, and let's use the case of Micrometrics being bought by Aeroflex.
Okay.
So,
which happened in what year?
So that happened in 2007.
Okay.
And one of the main reasons that, for me, one of the main reasons that I sold to Aeroflex was, I was going through some personal issues at that point in time, but I also was looking at a partner who owned 23% of the company who was 70 years old, a partner who owned 17% of the company who was 64 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So the problem became that I quickly recognized that there was a very good possibility, if I hung on to this for another 10 years, that I could see two of my business partners die and have to pay those estates millions of dollars in order to pay off the stock that they owned. Because as a private company, yeah. when people get that age, key man insurance doesn't apply. You can't afford the key man insurance. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars. One of my partners would have been, we sold the company for, $12 million, $11 million bucks. So you're talking about $3 million. And you don't have that kind of money back when you're running a full fab and your gross margins are in the 40s, the mid 40s to high 40s. You can't afford to write a check for $3 million and call it a day. Mm-hmm. So our bylaw was we had to pay the estate off over a 10-year period of time.
Yeah.
Well, that's $300,000 a year.
Yep.
There wasn't a single executive making over $170,000 a year at the time. So when you...
You definitely weren't in Silicon Valley.
Well, no, we didn't. We're in New Hampshire, so it's a lot different, right?
Yeah.
So the reasoning, when I'm looking at that, I'm looking at that and I'm saying, I'm having my own personal issues at home,
yeah.
but I'm also looking at it and I'm going, shit, if something happens to any of these people, I could be working the rest of my life to pay these estates off. And now it becomes an issue of what else is going on within the business. We weren't growing to the speed we weren't growing to, and it had nothing to do with debt. We had zero debt. We had $600,000 worth of debt in a $10 million company. Not a big deal, right? So it was a lot of turmoil. And then the other reason that you look at an acquisition, and this particular acquisition with Aeroflex, was opportunity. When they came in, they had profit sharing for the employees, something that we couldn't offer. They had better 401k, something that we couldn't offer. Better medical insurance, something that we couldn't offer. Something that we wanted to give to the employees to enhance their life and to make their quality of life better. So the acquisition originally started as, geez, this is gonna be good for the senior owners, it's gonna be good for me, it's gonna be good for the employees. Now, unfortunately, that happened at a time when Aeroflex was looking at going from being a public company to a private company and back to a public company. So their modus operandi was to reduce costs, reduce yeah. rooftop, try to build up the EBITDA to get to a point where they can relaunch the stock and make some money. So the problem was that while we were sold a bill of goods that sounded really good, the bill of goods very quickly eroded because Aeroflex's idea to get that done was to freeze wages, cut 401k, increase the self-funded medical insurance, freeze hiring, and do things that were really counterproductive to the morale of the business.
And you found that out after you signed and the
right.
ink dried.
Right, oh, this is a year later.
Yeah.
It's a year later.
Yeah.
So when you get into that type of situation, as the person who sold it to the employees that this was going to be a lot
right.
better.
Yeah, your life is going to be better and that now you're just.
Yeah, this is going to be great for everybody.
So what happens? Me as an owner, the other owners that were in the company, the employees are looking at us going, all right, well, you guys made all this money, and I just got my 401k cut, and I just got my salary frozen, and I've just got this done. And so for me, it was very difficult to come to work every day
yeah.
and sit there and look at that.
Yeah. So how long did you last before you decided to leave Aeroflex?
26 months.
I'm sure you loved every month.
I loved the first year.
Yeah.
And I think this is the other part that could play into the question of whether an acquisition is successful or not. If you're going to keep the owner of the company on or the founder of the company on, you ought to listen to them. And you shouldn't discount their input.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly, Aeroflex could have looked at their situation differently. Aeroflex could have said, you know what, let's freeze salaries above $75,000. Let's give raises to everybody that makes less than $75,000 because we realize that raising two kids on an employee who's making $20 an hour is really hard. And we need them to produce. We need them to put product out the door. Those are the people that build your company. The executives, I can hire a vice president tomorrow. I don't care about that. I can't find a wire bonder tomorrow. I can't find a die attach person right. tomorrow. But I can find a VP tomorrow because they're all out there,
yeah.
right?
Fungible skills.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's where the disconnect is. So for me, had they taken away the corporate jet, taken away executive bonuses, frozen salaries above $75,000, given raises to the people that were below that, I can guarantee them that their efficiencies would have gone up. The people would have rallied behind the company to increase profit. They would have sacrificed the 401k willfully. They would have sacrificed the health insurance extra willfully because the company was also helping them advance. And that wasn't the case.
Did you make that case?
Of course I did.
And how was that met?
That was not met well. That was not met well. I mean, dude, honestly, if you're an executive making $150,000, you don't need a $25,000 bonus. I'm sorry, yeah. You don't. And if you do, you're living beyond your means.
You know what? You don't sound like a Reagan Republican.
Probably true.
I'm listening to, like, you know, I watch like 30 Rock, like Jack Donaghy. I'm like, nah, that's not Jack Donaghy.
No.
Do you ever see the episode where Kenneth sees Jack Donaghy's paycheck? And he was like, it was really big, and then I saw more zeros. And then I unfolded it. All right, so you left 26 months into Aeroflex, and that's 2009? Okay, so that's also like a terrible time for the RF
big
industry.
Crash.
So in 34 years now of business, I have never had a year where any one of my companies has gone down in sales. And every time the economy turned downward, I advanced the company. So in 2000, it was another bad year, right?
Yeah.
So 2000, everybody was Y2, in 1999, everybody was Y2K crazy.
Yep.
They thought the whole world was gonna end.
Internet bubble. Pre-9/11.
All this stuff was going on. And we put a $2 million addition on our building and built a huge fab. And we took that American Valence that we had out in California, we moved it to the East Coast, and we consolidated our company. And that year, we did, in 1999, the company did 5.1 million, and in 2000, the company did 5.1 million. That was the only flat year I ever had in 34 mm-hmm. years. Yeah. And that was economy driven, that wasn't because of us.
Yeah.
But in that year, we put a $2.2 million addition on the building. So to start a business in a tough time, to me, is the best time to start a business, because when you're inundated with orders, you can't execute.
That's so interesting, because Doug and I were talking about this last episode, where it was like, my dad started Markey in 1991 in the Peace Dividend, and all he had ever done was sell the military hybrid mixers. It was like the dumbest possible time to go walk up to Westinghouse and say, do you want more mixers?
You know? Right.
So, okay, so 2009, you're jobless.
I am jobless.
What are you thinking at that moment?
I think I'm going to start a company and do it.
Did you have a statute of limitations or like a waiting period?
I had a non-compete and honestly, the other thing too is when you're in business and you sign a contract, you honor the contract. So my non-compete was specifically to semiconductor devices, but it didn't have anything to do with contract manufacturing or RF microwave assembly. So the neat thing was that I knew I was going to get back into diodes. The bad thing was I had to wait 3 years. But the good thing was that if I started a company for RF microwave assembly, all the toys that you buy or all the assets of equipment that you buy for RF microwave assembly,
yeah.
Oh my God, they just happen to be the same toys that you need to build diodes.
You're building the car without the engine.
You're building the car without the engine, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my thought process was build up this business, get it up to $1.5 million. By 2012, we're back in the diode business and we're gonna just rock and roll.
Okay, so did you know, I think we must have met around within the first 2 years you were doing this.
Yeah, I think we met around 2011.
That sounds about right. So that was when I was starting the Microlithic. And did you know that there was a complete shortage of skilled high-frequency packaging experts in the United States?
No.
You didn't know that?
Had no idea.
Wow, you hid that well, because I thought that you started Semigen to fill this void.
No.
Like, you sniffed that out and then played that poker hand well.
No. It was weird, because the way that Semigen came to fruition was I needed to get out of Aeroflex. And the only thing my lawyers told me I could do was RF microwave assembly.
Right.
So it's like, all right, I got this.
Oh, you must have loved me then. So I said, Jim, I have diodes that I need packaged.
Yeah.
You're like, that doesn't violate my...
That doesn't violate my deal.
He gave me the diodes, everybody.
That's right.
So you got to do exactly what you always did, with me at least.
Right.
But I supplied you diodes that I had already owned.
Correct.
Wow. Okay, so I really helped you.
Oh, well, you originally went to Aeroflex and asked them to do the packaging.
Right.
And they were not interested, or they offered some exorbitant fee.
No. They actually were willing to do it okay. Incidentally,
eventually,
we now employ the exact assembler
yeah.
who now used
We could say all this because Aeroflex doesn't exist as a company anymore. Right. So.
Well, they may have even been cobbled at this point.
I can say all this anyway because I don't care. But.
But the long and short of it was that it was pretty clear that, you know, Metallix wasn't going to be like a packaging house.
Right.
So it was like, it was a very weird situation where they were almost like a contract manufacturer, but they weren't, because they were packaging their stuff in my supplied assemblies. And it was just a kind of logistical nightmare. So when Jim came around, I was like, Jim, I got this. He's like, this is perfect. I could do this easy.
What's funny to me is that it's what, like the sixth time in Jim's career that he's doing something better than the company that, like he started off competing with MACOM on the line that he was working on at MACOM, and then bought lines from MACOM to do it better than MACOM was doing, and then started SemiGen and was doing this assembly job from, sold his company to Aeroflex, and then was doing an assembly job that we originally went to Aeroflex to do better than Aeroflex could do it themselves.
Right.
So you've been, do you think it's efficiency or, like, why?
Customer service, man. The big difference, they could do it just as well as he could.
Absolutely.
He would do it faster.
Right.
He did it cheaper. And he did it with a smile on his face. I wasn't burdening him.
Yeah.
He was happy to take my PO. I was happy to write the PO. And I mean, that this is like what American capitalism at its best.
Right.
He had a value to offer me. I could support him in his fledgling situation. And I think we also hit it off because you saw what I had sort of a father-son situation. You had a father-son situation. I remember the first time we met in person, we talked about that for like an hour. And it was like, this is cool. Like, he understands what I'm doing. And that was kind of like why we got along right away. But what's your answer?
I have no idea.
So customer service, we talked about this a lot.
Oh, customer service.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so the reason that I, and listen, it's easy for people to be self-centered or egotistical or pompous or whatever, but the reality is that I think that I humbly recognize that for a 20-year-old kid to start a semiconductor company and to grow it to the birth that we grew Micrometrics to was all about the people that worked for me. From Tim Filto to Donald Langan to Fred Gelligan to my job as the CEO of the company is to steer the ship and hire people that are a lot smarter than I am and keep those people focused and moving forward in a direction that capitalizes on the goals of the company. So customer service is hugely important. It goes back to my roots when my mom was a waitress and said the customer is always right. And if the eggs are cold, the eggs are cold. Whether they came off the griddle 2 seconds ago or not, the customer is always right. And we have always managed our business under that premise that the customer is always right. We will take care of the customer. Our employees, our manufacturing floor has sales orders out on the, work orders out on the manufacturing floor that are blank, devoid of revenue. Here's another example where you have large companies who try to make a number for a month and they pull orders, the highest revenue order to ship. We treat every single order the same. If it's a $500 order or a $50,000 order, because I don't want that assembler knowing a couple things. One, I don't want that assembler knowing that they're working on a $50,000 order. Why? Because it's going to make their efficiency go down because they're going to be nervous that it's worth that much money. That's a lot of money to somebody making $18, $19 an hour. Why put that stress on them? Why have a manager stand over them and say, this is a $50,000 order, we must ship this Friday? No, we must satisfy the customer. We satisfy customers, we don't satisfy orders.
Well, Jim, I think you're missing something though. So you're talking about the customer, but people who don't know the names you just named, Donald Langdon and Tim Filto, currently work for you, and you mentioned their names happening, what, 2 decades ago?
2 decades ago.
They've followed you throughout this whole time. That, to me, says something. Well, whatever you want to say. But the fact is that it's not just customers. It's the employee base.
True.
There was meaning behind the work, and maybe it's your leadership, maybe it's them, maybe it's you getting lucky and you riding their coattails. But the point is, like, you can't discount the team aspect and the cultural aspect of creating this organization. It is customer first, but you can't satisfy the customers unless, you know, you're executing with your team. So it's no secret, or it's no shock to me, that you can keep winning with the same group of people in a completely different organization.
I think that's true to a certain degree. I think that one of the things that I learned in life, that it's like that trip with your wife to New York City that you had, that was the most amazing trip of your life, and you had the most romantic time at the Empire State Building, and you did everything right. And then 3 years later, your wife says, I want to go back to New York City, and you go back and it's a dud. It just doesn't reproduce. So the reality that you have to recognize is there is some things you can reproduce in business, and there's some things that just need to change. So while I have surrounded myself with former Micrometrics folks that I trust and that I know, it's for specific particular areas that I know that I can't find a better skill set. But there's other areas that I want to find a better skill set, because I've done it this way before. I want to see if I can do it better. So are there smarter people out there? Are there more effective people out there? Are there more energetic people out there? Are there more passionate people out there that can maybe create an idea that we didn't even think of in order to allow us to go down a different road? Because if you stack it with all the same people, you're just going to have the same thing again. And Micrometrics didn't work.
So it's more as good as
Semigen is working.
So it's more like, I suppose, if you're like the GM of a team. I look at my job as like kind of a GM, right?
Yeah.
So you have a core. You have your Tom Brady type mm-hmm. player, like your untouchables.
Right.
So what you're saying is you build around a core with new draft picks where you're looking for specific skills. So at this point in your guys' situation, where do you need to get better? Like, is your cornerback hurting?
Well,
is your linebacker a problem?
There's a good, let's talk about workforce.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about workforce today, and let's talk about U.S. manufacturing today.
Okay.
All right. So there is a definite, we have, as industry leaders in the RF microwave world, we have failed to understand what a depth chart is and to understand what building and mentoring is in our industry. We have been The farm system.
Yeah.
We have been so inundated with trying to ship today's order and make tomorrow's bonus and do all these things that we've lost the ability to say, whoa, time out. We need to make sure that we're getting kids from the Institute of Technology. We need to make sure that we're getting kids involved in this. We need to make sure that we're stacking up assemblers to replace the assemblers that we have.
Yes.
My average workforce right now at Semigen a year ago was 58 years old. I have brought that average down to 49. Mm-hmm. I have to get it down to 35.
Yeah.
And the problem is that we can't find people that want to do this job because we've been so nosed down for the last 20 years, focused on shipping product and focused on building things, that we haven't recognized that all these engineers around us and all these people that we rely on, they're all getting older. And we're not doing anything to replace these people.
Well, I think I'd push back. I don't think it's that we've been focused on shipping. It's that we've been focused on saving every last possible dime to manufacture things in, let's say, the Philippines.
Fine. Yep.
Or Thailand or China or wherever else it is. Even in the defense industry.
The biggest
semiconductor companies in the world with 80% margins don't manufacture in the US.
That's right.
And their margin would go down to 79.9% if they had just built a contract manufacturer up in, let's say, Kentucky. It's unfathomable to me. I don't understand.
You look at costs to manufacture in China. Those are going to get more pricey as the decades move forward.
It's already,
yeah. Right? So you have tariffs going on. You have other stuff going on. I'm sure that companies who are heavily invested in Asian manufacturing or heavily invested in South African manufacturing or wherever you want to put it.
Yeah.
The reality is that pushing manufacturing offshore has caused a gap in our workforce. Mm-hmm. Because those jobs are not there for those people, so those people went elsewhere.
Yes.
It's as simple as that.
Yep.
I mean, if you want to state a case of the main reason why microwave manufacturing is hurting right now for people, that's a good reason.
Yes, we basically we're missing at least one generation, maybe two generations. So when did we start really pushing up things to China? Like in the 80s?
No. We started 70s? Pushing stuff out late 90s, early 2000s.
It was that late?
Yeah, I think because so Skyworks is Alpha Industries is a good example, because when the cell phone market started to boom, that's really when Alpha started to push manufacturing to Asia for the plastic packages.
Yeah.
So when we needed to take a diode that normally sold for $4 and sell it for 12 cents, that's what caused a lot of this stuff to go offshore, because you couldn't manufacture it.
It was the commercial electronics industry really pushing us. But at the same time, the rug got swept out from under us. Everything went. The talent went.
Well, you had a perfect storm, right? So let's just be honest. In the Obama administration, defense spending was cut tremendously. All right? So we didn't have a lot of that business. And then the commercial cell phone business took off as well.
Yeah.
So you had a huge push to the Asian markets for cheaper labor and for higher manufacturing at lower cost. And you had a defense industry that went down.
Yes.
So companies like BAE, Lockheed, Raytheon, General Dynamics, those companies who are the catalysts of our industry weren't making systems, weren't making subsystems. Mm-hmm. And so they tailed off their business. So all these people...
And they also could not push their suppliers to keep going.
Right.
They weren't... Marky Microwave, as an example, we were not relying on them for our expansion.
Right.
We were finding other avenues to get better at. One example is we rode the coattails of things like iPhones through third and fourth tier, you know, supply chain situation. Like, we weren't selling to Apple, but you know, we were benefiting from that. And so the military essentially wasn't large enough to be interesting to a lot of us.
Well, so you're taking a look at kids coming out of high school, going into college, going to be engineers. They don't want to be an engineer. And then let's also back up and let's associate the fact that we had the internet boom, the dot-com boom, the boom of
social
Amazon,
media.
Google. Yeah. We have, and when you go to the Bay Area now, you have, are you a Googler? Do you work at Google? Do you do? So our industry, really, people found other things to do.
Yep.
Military was down, commercial was up, but the commercial was manufactured overseas.
Yes.
So we just basically cut our entire skill set and relied on the people that are sitting at the bench, because we weren't hiring new people.
Yeah. So there's like a lost generation, effectively.
I would say there's at least a 10 to 15 year gap in assembly generation people.
Yeah. Okay. So when I met you, maybe I recognized your value before you did then, because when I met you, the first thing I thought was, this guy's going to make a lot of money just packaging people's chips, because they don't even know how to. Because you can't, like, there's a need for a US-based packaging company, and you were offering those services at reasonable prices. That was the other thing. It's not like, I wasn't asking you to do it for 7 cents.
Right.
You know, it was okay if it was, you know, a couple bucks here and there. Like, you weren't trying to get 100,000 piece orders.
Right.
So like there was, and that's the other problem, or the other challenge that military work has, is that, you know, good orders are hundreds to tens of thousands. Very rare to see much more than that in let's say the high-end IC space.
Right.
So did you recognize that you were filling a gap? You must have.
By about 2000, so the company, we started this in 2009. By 2012, 2013 timeframe, I pretty much knew how bad the workforce was.
Okay.
Because there were people complaining all over the place that they couldn't find people.
Yes.
And you know what, SemiGen is kind of unique in the fact that we look to constantly rebuild our workforce all the time. Mm-hmm. So we actually have people on staff in the company now at $9.50 to $11 an hour that don't know anything about how to wire bond or how to die attach or how to etch or how to do any of this, but they follow people around all day long, because those are the people of tomorrow. So we have invested, and we'll probably, I mean, if I had to put a percentage on it, Chris, I'd have to tell you that out of the 60 people that we have at SemiGen,
I would tell you that probably six of those people, 10% of our workforce, are non-contributing workforce. They're training.
Yes.
They're training workforce for tomorrow.
So you are just going to handle it yourself.
Excuse me?
In other words, you're going to take this problem and solve it in a private way.
We have to.
Do you believe that there's anything that, you know, the DOD might need to do something about this? Like, I've heard about certain very large companies in New England area soaking up as much talent as they can for expansion. Is there anything that anybody can do on like a, let's say, a policy level or a governmental level to help this? Because I don't see there's any short-term solution to it besides me or you hiring as many people as we can and training ourselves.
So, you know, I don't know how it works in California.
well, it's not going to be done in California, probably.
I can tell you that I had a business in California from the time I bought it in 1992 to the time I moved it out 3 years later, and I couldn't wait to get out. I think California is business adverse with the amount of taxes that they have. So in the state of New Hampshire, where we have no sales tax, no income tax, no capital gains tax, we have a good relationship with our government officials. It's a small state.
Well,
we only have 1.7 million people. Huh?
Aren't you one of
them? At the local level, I am, but at the state level.
Can you explain to the listeners what your official title is?
So I'm just a town councilor in the town that I live in, but in the...
But you were voted by the voters.
Oh, yeah. I got elected.
So you were officially... Twice, actually. You are a politician.
I am a facilitator of political issues.
There you go.
Say that.
Okay.
But the governor in the state of New Hampshire is the youngest governor in the United States, and he is very aware because some of his highest donors are defense contractors. So he is very aware of the workforce issue, and in our state, we're doing a bunch of things for workforce enhancement. And I think it goes back to parents of today. You know, it's okay for your kid to go to trade school. It's okay for your kid to go to electronics school.
Yeah.
It's okay for that. You need to, as a parent today, you need to assess, one, I go back to the old football days, right? Everybody wants their kid to be the quarterback, but the reality is not everybody can play quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
We have to apply that in how we look at our children objectively, because a lot of parents look at their kids as they can do no wrong. They're the best in the whole wide world. If you're gonna do the best thing for your kid, assess your kid's capabilities and say, you know what, Johnny's not gonna be a doctor, Sarah's not gonna be a pharmacist, but they'd be really good at a baker, or they'd be really good as an electrician, or they'd be really good as a carpenter, or they'd be really good as an engineer.
And there's dignity in that word.
And there's
dignity in that.
And what my generation did in the 80s, because the 80s was this generation of, you know, buy it, spend it, dress it, use it, right? Throw it away. Buy it, spend it, dress it, use it, throw it away. That was the 80s. And what happened in the 80s was we developed this idea that everybody has to go to college. Everybody has to have a four-year degree. And I pushed my kids to go to college. My son probably didn't need to go to college. My son probably would have been happy doing something completely different than college, where my daughter belonged in college. She went on, you know, she went to art school, she got her master's degree, she's moving in this direction. My son didn't need to do that. And it's not that my son or my daughter are gonna do any differently, it's just that as parents, you had this idea that, oh no, you gotta go to college. Well, the reality is that when I was a kid, college was $25,000, 4 years, done, right? For a mediocre school. You could get a great school for $50,000. Today you're looking at $150,000, $200,000. So we've developed a society where we're pushing our children to go rack up these huge bills. How the hell is a 22-year-old going to afford a $150,000 student loan and buy a house and start a family and get a job? How do they do that? So the reality is we have to understand that there's dignity in every job. If you're a janitor, God bless you. Thank you very much for that work. That's a dignified job. I'm sorry. It doesn't matter, as long as you love your work and you're passionate about it, that should be what you care about.
We shouldn't be looking down on people's positions. We should be enhancing people's positions. And that goes to the workforce problem that we have in our industry as a whole. When you culminate all of those issues that we just talked about together, here's where we are, a generation and a half behind. So I recognized that in 2012. That's why I put the training program in place so that we're constantly building our staff up, okay? And if we don't do that, we're gonna reach critical capacity where a customer will come in and say, I need this built, and we're gonna look at them and say, well, we can't deliver that for 18 weeks because we're slammed. We, in our business, we don't have the luxury to do that. We have to satisfy every single customer no matter what.
So at this point, what's next?
What's
your goals for SemiGen? You've brought Tim Filto back. He's one of your former proteges, and now he's president, right?
Correct.
Talented guy, doing a lot. You're on vacation every time I call
he's
you.
He's president because I recognized the fact that my company was growing at such a fast rate that if I didn't divide and conquer upper management, and bring somebody in let's go back to the original statement that I made earlier. My job is to hire people that are smarter than me and put them into roles for success. Mm-hmm. Tim is smarter than I am.
I agree with that. Yeah, okay? That's definitely true.
Okay. So, and that, you know what? That's okay. Because the reality is that what's next for SemiGen is that we can paint any direction and any future that we want. Where are we going to be strong? We're going to be strong in RF microwave assembly because there's not going to be a lot of people out there over the next decade that can do this stuff. And the beauty of our particular product, whether we're making a multifunction assembly or whether we're making a filter or whether we're making an oscillator, you can't automate that stuff because you're making 100 of this, 200 of that, 900 of that. It's not worth automating. We're not making hundreds of thousands of pieces.
Yeah.
And so what's next for SemiGen? The sky's the limit because we look at every opportunity as an individualistic opportunity. We look at every customer as a new venture and a new goal and a new game. And we manage our company with the intent of growing the business to benefit the employees that work there and the customers that we service.
What do you want personally?
You know what? I have been very fortunate in my life, okay? I've been fortunate to work with a great team of people. I've been fortunate to have amazing parents. I've been fortunate to have amazing spouses. I've been fortunate to have amazing children. And I've been able to do what I want to do. So to answer your question, I can put it in a very good perspective. When I was 13 years old, my dad asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I said, I want to own a business, and I want to be the richest man in the world, okay? And my dad looked at me, and he said, what's rich to you? And I didn't have an answer for him. I didn't know what rich was. I just knew that people were rich, and they had all these things, right? And my dad said, you know what's rich for me? He said, what's rich for me is being able to take my family on a two-week vacation every year. Being able to see my children grow and be able to spend those 2 weeks, because he worked three jobs. So to be able to spend those 2 weeks outside of work and learn about what my son has learned over the time and be able to have that, he goes, to me, that's rich. If I can afford to go on vacation, if I can afford to buy a new car, if I can afford to take my wife out to dinner, to me, that's rich. So that grounded that. For me. So for me, I want to ride the wave. I want to make the people that work for me successful. I want to make my customers successful. And in turn for that, I'll be successful.
Thanks for listening to our episode today. Special thanks to Jim Morgan for spending a couple hours with us and dealing with all the technical issues of live recording. If you want to contact Jim or his company, you can reach them at semigen.net. As always, you can contact Doug and I at markymicrowave.com.